Good afternoon, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona. And thanks for tuning in to another of our virtual events. And it's always a delight to have Val McDermid back with us. We'd love to have her in person, but we will settle for having her virtually to discuss her brand new book, Past Lying. And we have unsigned US copies in stock, but Val has signed a batch of this exclusive Scottish edition. And we have just a handful of signed copies left. And so I'll go ahead and put a link in the comments field, should you wish to purchase one. And if you have questions for Val, go ahead and type them in. And Barbara will bring me back on screen towards the end of the hour, and I would be happy to ask any questions. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Val, it's really a pleasure to see you. I think you're in New York, aren't you, rather than back home in Scotland?
I'm back in Edinburgh now. We flew back at the weekend.
Ah, okay. Well, in any case, so it's nighttime for Val, even though it's noon here, but she's crisp and alert as ever. So Val, before I do anything about the book, I have to ask you, we watched Karen Piri on BritBox season one, and we absolutely fell in love with it. This is book 7 of Karen Piri. So my question is, do you know if they are going to do further seasons?
Well, as it happens, I just dropped, what dropped into my inbox this afternoon was the first draft of the first script for the next series. So the plan is to work their way through the books.
I am so glad to hear that. I'm making a big pitch for everybody watching this to tune in and watch it. It's really well done. Love the cast. You Outlander fans will get a person in the person of Karen Piri, as I recall, who's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, she just won a Scottish BAFTA for her role in Karen Piri.
How great.
And she won an audience choice vote as well, also over Brian Cox in Succession.
Aha. Well, you know, well-deserved. I just thought it was a terrific first season. You've had very good luck with television, haven't you?
I have. That's because I'm quite careful about who I choose to work with, though. I don't always say yes when people come knocking.
Right. And the other thing I wanted to ask you about was, how did you like your time in Otago, New Zealand, which is one of my favorite places? You and your partner, Joe, you were there for what, a semester or some such thing?
Yeah, we were there. Well, we were in New Zealand for 4 months. We were 2.5 months in Otago, and then we went up to the North Island. I've got a visiting professorship at the University of Otago in Dunedin. So that's going to be a routine for every other year for the foreseeable future, for as long as they want me. They have a Centre for Irish and Scottish Studies there. It's the only Scottish Studies Centre outside Scotland, in fact. And the professor, Liam McIlvany, of course, is a name you'll recognise. So he's very much flying the flag for Scottish crime writing, and I'm his visiting professor.
Wow, what a really wonderful deal. I love Dunedin, and I can say, and I'm sure Val visited, they have this fabulous train station, which is basically based on a Scottish train station, isn't it?
Yes. Based on the station in Perth, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't. Okay. But anyway, it's absolutely wonderful. And there's a little train that goes off from Dunedin up into the mountains. And there's also, and I'm trying to remember, there's two different bird things that happen out there. We drove out from Dunedin out to one peninsula to see whatever one sanctuary was, but they're also famous for another. So I'm making a pitch for New Zealand because I just love it. Like people to go there.
It's the albatross sanctuary on the peninsula, at the tip of the peninsula. It's the only inhabited land in the world where albatrosses breed. And they also have the little blue penguins and the yellow penguins out on the peninsula, and sea lions. It's quite an amazing place for natural history.
It is. It's wonderful. And the road that snakes along it is a lot like the Amalfi Drive. Or actually, it's more like the drive on the Gaspé Peninsula, because you're so close to the water, it actually can wash over the road while you're trying to go there.
And some friends of ours on the wildlife cruise ship, the cruise boat that goes up to the Albatross Sanctuary and beyond out to sea. So whenever we're there, we always have a trip or two out when the weather is right and the tide's in the right place.
Well, as I said, I'm truly envious that you got to spend time there. And that sounds wonderful if you get to keep going back. But meantime, we are in Edinburgh during lockdown. And I want to say, Val, that I'm not sure that certainly I and many Americans really didn't understand just how severe your lockdown restrictions were.
Yeah. Yeah, it was strict. And people stuck to it, by and large, certainly in Scotland. Our politicians were not partying.
Right. No, I mean, it sort of helped me understand why there was so much outrage against Boris Johnson and similar, you know, who flouted the rules. When your characters in here, well, Karen does a little dip here and there, but mostly everybody is trying very hard to stick with the lockdown rules. And in fact, you use those to create some tension between Karen and a romantic partner, because he has a more liberal interpretation of the rules than she is comfortable with.
That's probably because he grew up in America.
Well, I also thought that as a novelist, you probably wanted to split them up, you know, just because it makes things more interesting. But you know, I think that so much a part of this book is understanding how difficult it would be. Actually, let me read you my little introduction here, which I love when I wrote it up. So what you get with this, Jim, is a bookish plot involving authors behaving badly, archivists, an expansive tour of Edinburgh, and as it is said in the spring of 2020, a brilliantly realized account of what life was like under the UK's strict lockdown and the choices people made to follow the rules or flout them, which is a real impediment either way to an unsolved crimes, aka cold case investigation, with a most unusual origin story originating in an archive. Was that okay?
Fine. Perfect.
Did anybody send you the Wall Street Journal review that came out on Saturday?
Yeah, I was sent that. It's had some amazing reviews in the US. It's been pretty much universally praised, which has been lovely, actually. It's been picked up pretty much everywhere and said very nice things.
They did. Well, I think Tom Nolan did an excellent job. I won't bother to read it, but he went on and I thought did a terrific review, which I have quoted at some length in our own publication. Yes. So, book seven, do you feel like, you know, sometimes when you're at book seven in a series, people don't wax necessarily that enthusiastic. So why is it you think that this book has touched so many chords?
I think because we went through a phase with COVID where we all were very frightened and very anxious, and none of us knew what was going to happen. None of us knew what what the outcome was going to be. Was this going to be the one that sees us all off? Was this going to be the one that we'd actually be able to deal with? And I think that looking back at it, I couldn't write about it at the time, but looking back at it, I think it's something that is we need to remember. And one of the things about the Karen Perry novels is them being cold case novels alongside 79 and 89 and onwards into that, is that I'm trying to write against times that have momentous events that are very quickly forgotten, but we need to remember, I think. And so Karen allows me to do that without being sort of sententious about it. They're just part of the backdrop to the story. And I think for me, it was quite important to capture what Edinburgh was like in that period, because most people who don't know the city tend to come at times that are very busy, like during the festival, during New Year, when the city's packed and everything's lively and there's flashing lights on street gardens and it's like a party. But I thought it was interesting to write about an Edinburgh that was empty. It was very strange to be the only people walking down George IV Bridge, or, you know, almost nobody on Princes Street. And that was something I wanted to try and capture.
Or along the water. You know, you use the word in Edinburgh, the word tenements means something different than what I think most Americans expect. Because there's a real down market kind of connotation to the word tenement here. But in Edinburgh, that isn't what it means at all, is it?
No. And in Scotland, we have these sort of multi-Victorian tenement buildings, which are multiple occupancy. They have usually rather grand buildings, stone built, and, you know, each particular close, as it's called, will have perhaps four or six apartments in the close. So it's quite posh. You know, there's parts of Edinburgh where you'll pay the best part of £1.5 million for a tenement flat.
Well, I only mentioned it. Those of you Americans reading the book might, you know, think tenements and how could it be like this? But that's what they are, multiple family dwellings. So Val and I have known each other forever. And when we first met, she was in Oxford and living in that part of England. And over the years that I've known her, she keeps moving north. And now she's back to Edinburgh, which, you know, because she is originally in Scotland. And do you think, you know, because a lot of your earlier books, most of them, in fact, were set in England. Do you think the Karen Puris are, you know, are, well, not do you think, are they more fun for you to write because you're back home?
I don't know about more fun to write, but they're certainly easier to write because I know exactly what I'm writing about. And I know exactly the kind of places I'm talking about. So I have, I suppose, a stronger sense of rootedness than I did when I was setting the books where I was just happened to be living. But it's definitely, I mean, sense of place has always been very important to me, both as a reader and as a writer. I mean, the books that I remember, that I cleave to, if you like, are the ones where I can picture the landscape, you know, like Sarah Paretsky's Wachowski novels. I mean, first time I went to Chicago, I felt like I knew the place already because Sarah describes it so well and so evocatively. Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles, again, same thing. You get that real sense of what the place is like. And I think that's something that with the crime novel becomes a very important factor. If you do it well, you really take the reader with you. And that means they believe all the lies you're telling them. Because everybody knows murders are not solved the way we write about them.
I love that. I hadn't really thought about it adding verisimilitude to an otherwise unconvincing story. I'm sure I quoted that from something. But, you know, I did feel with the TV, Karen Puri, and I felt, you know, reading the books, because I read them all as you've written them, that Edinburgh and Scotland are indeed characters in the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I guess, you know, I've sort of found my way back to where I started from and to find it a very different place, which has been an interesting experience. I mean, when I started writing the Karen Puris, I was not living in Scotland. I was still living in England. And so it was kind of almost a harking back to my past. But now it's very much in my present. So I'm writing about the streets that I walk every day and the places that I know, like, and the resources I know, like the National Library of Scotland, which is where this book really starts. And so it feels very familiar, and I don't have to do quite so much research.
I can see that. I mean, it's been a very nice circle that your life has taken, you know, from from Scotland down to England and then wandering back up to Manchester and Northumberland and, you know, back to Edinburgh. My life has taken some odd turns as well, and I often say to myself that it's better to have a happy ending than necessarily a great beginning. I think that's true. I'm glad that my life turned out the way it did. I'm really happy for you that your life is turning out the way it is.
Well, I've never been happier than I have been for the last 10 years. So, yeah, I mean, I think you maybe have to mess up a little bit along the way to appreciate the good stuff when it comes.
I think so, too. No question about it. So, Karen, tell us a bit about Karen Puri for people who haven't read her, you know. What kind of person is she?
Karen is a cold case detective. She runs the historic cases unit in Police Scotland. She used to run the Fife Police historic cases, but then when the different forces in Scotland amalgamated to be one, she got the job of running the case unit for the whole of Scotland. She's a detective chief inspector. She has a very, very small team. She's just expanded it to two people underneath her because a lot of the top brass don't think that cold cases are very important. Karen thinks they are important because she thinks it's really vital to bring people, to give answers to people who have had someone in their life disappear or be murdered, whatever. She thinks it's important to give people closure. She's passionate about justice. She's difficult at times. She's there are two Scottish words that I think sum up Karen very well, thrawn and gallus. And thrawn is a word that just basically means bloody-minded and determined, someone who doesn't give up. And gallus is someone who's got a bit of a swagger and a bit of self-confidence. And she has the appearance, the facade of the self-confidence and the swagger, but she's not quite as swaggery underneath. And she's she lives in Edinburgh now, and she's had some personal tragedies to deal with in the past, but she moves forward. She's not someone who gives in or gives up.
I have to admit that to some degree, I see you, a younger you, when I'm reading about Karen. Well,
I don't know if I've got her tenacity. I don't know if I've got her concentration. I think I've probably got a pretty similar sense of humour, because that's one thing you can't invent. Because the only thing you find funny is what you find funny.
That's true. Do you remember a night sitting in the garden at St. Hilda when you introduced me to the chalet girls? Oh, Lord.
The chalet school still remains, you know, part of my hinterland. You know, it taught me so many things. The chalet school series of novels taught me the quality of having characters develop over a series rather than remain static. You know, because when things happen in the chalet school books, they have consequences. You know, it's books that are set in Austria and Switzerland and take place over a term or a year in the life of the school. And these young women, they grow up and they have lives afterwards, and they have careers, or they marry and have children. So it has a sense of consequence, as I say. And so many other books that one reads as a child, and indeed so many crime novels that one reads, these terrible things happen to people and it seems to have no impact on them. Yeah. You know, it doesn't really matter what order you read Miss Marple in. She stays pretty much the same. You know, she never drops her head into her hands and goes, "Why is it that all my friends are dead?" So I think readers have become a little more mature in their expectation. Readers like that sense of characters that move forward, that grow and change and develop. And so that, I think, places a challenge on the writer. And that means that, I mean, I've got a very short concentration span. I've got very, very low boredom threshold. I can't actually write two books back to back with the same character, because by the end of one book, I'm fed up and I want to move on. I discovered that when I gave up the day job, and I was in the middle of writing my second Kate Brannigan novel, and I thought, can't be bothered with this woman. She's smarter than me, she's funnier than me, she's thinner than me, she's better at computer games than me. I don't want to spend my days with her. And so I realised at that point that I had to mix it up a bit, write different characters, write different kinds of books. I suppose in a way, with the Ali Burns books, 1979 and 1989, I'm kind of giving the lie to my own conviction. But I feel with those books, because there's the 10-year gap between them, Ali has changed and moved on and is doing different things and is in a different place. And it's not like writing a book that follows straight on from the previous one. So I think I can live with that.
Well, Kate Brannigan was based in part upon your own journalism, you know, career, wasn't she? I still remember you saying that, you know, that you had to take her out of high heels and put her into, you would call them, well, we call them sneakers anyway, because she couldn't run if she were appearing at the door in high heels. I always thought that was a great piece of wisdom, you know, for women. If you're going to go somewhere dangerous, you know, wear the right shoes in case you
need to. Yeah, I remember when I did my research for the book I did back in the 90s for about women private eyes, about real women private eyes, I remember the wonderful Jean Mignolet in Florida saying to me, I was doing all this training and they were saying, here's how you shoot. I said, don't teach me how to shoot, teach me how to run in heels.
Right. So, I mean, there is, you know, I suppose every writer, there has to be a certain amount of biography in what they write. But I felt like the Brannigans were very close to you, you know, in terms of your, were they the first novel? They were the first novels you wrote, weren't they?
No, the Lindsay Gordon ones were the first ones.
Oh, it was Lindsay. Okay, yeah. That's right. Wow. Yeah. Do you know, I actually have a set of them.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. Amazing. So anyway, yeah. Karen, I love the idea that she refers to the cold case unit as the unsolved crimes unit, which I think is a far superior way of looking at it. Because it does mean that they're, you know, they're still alive and somebody ought to be investigating. So you make a real point of that. I'm thinking of using that term whenever I wind up with a plot that has a cold case thing. I'm thinking of just switching and calling it unsolved crimes. Because it lends an immediacy to it, and also a, I don't know what the word is, but, you know, it's irrelevancy, as you point out. You know, if it's a cold case, it doesn't really matter whether somebody's been missing for however long it's been.
Well, if it's your husband, wife, child, parent that is missing, that doesn't ever end for you until you have an answer.
Right.
It's always there for you. It's something that can, I mean, it will infect your life, because whenever something happens in your life that you want to tell them about, they're not there. You know, whenever you've got a new job or you've got a new romance or whatever like that, or you've got a new baby, you want to tell them, you want to share it with them, and they're not there. So that absence never goes away. That absence is as real 10 years, 15 years on as it was at the time. Yeah, I was talking to a very dear friend of mine the other day, and she lost her husband 3 years ago. And we're talking about him, and she said, you know, I imagined it would get easier as time went by, but I find it harder, because there's so many things that I want to share and I can't share them with him because he's never going to be there again. And I guess that's what it's like if somebody just disappears from your life, that particularly if they're someone that you're close to, you're perpetually being tortured by this absence.
Well, crime writers unfortunately have to deal with advances in technology. So, you know, the old gumshoe idea has been replaced to some degree by some guy working computers. But the good news is for unsolved cases that forensic advances have made it possible to get answers for cases that didn't exist 25 years ago. You know, DNA genetic databases, you know, all sorts of things make it possible. We've had quite a few crimes here in Arizona, Val, that have been solved recently, you know, by new techniques. And people, there was a particularly vicious killing here maybe 40 years ago or something, and they did preserve some aspect of the woman's clothing or something, and they were able recently to break it down and discover who the actual killer was and arrest him, which, you know, makes it, in other words, unsolved cases are now possibly solved, whereas real cases, yeah, you know, there was maybe never going to be any way to actually work them. And, you know, eyewitnesses, we both know, are notoriously unreliable. And, you know, testimony can be tainted by people's own agenda or people hiding things they don't want revealed. But you can't really beat the actual science. This is, okay, the semen on this woman's pants, that's him.
Yeah. And of course, what's been a real huge step forward has been the development of familial DNA.
Right.
And some of the some of these ancestry sites leading to criminals that thought they'd got away with it because of a familial connection through the DNA. And that's, I mean, some people sort of are anxious that somehow all this technology is destroying the crime novel. And that, you know, it all becomes a matter of science and not a matter of interviewing and examining the facts and understanding how people work. But I think that's a challenge, not a danger. It's a challenge to accommodate that within your work and to find ways of exploring these issues. I don't know if you read Jo Callaghan's debut novel last year, In the Blink of an Eye.
Mm-hmm.
She has the AI hologram detective. And that's I mean, I find that a really interesting approach, because it's the marriage of the absolute leading edge with a detective who still believes that the instinct and gut and understanding how people respond is an important part of the job. So I like to see people taking on the challenge rather than sitting in the corner being grumpy about it.
I like that, sitting in the corner being grumpy about it. Well, let's talk about the archivist. What do you know about archives? I mean, you know, in order to write this book, you had to be realistic about, you know, the Scottish National Archives.
Well, I don't know very much about it, to be honest, but I do know that they like to have the archives from writers, and they've made an approach to me for my archives. And I don't know how they'll find their way through my cardboard boxes of bits of paper, but, you know, that's their job. And the thing that surprised me was that they said they weren't interested in my bank statements or my tax returns. And I thought there were bound to be a PhD in there somewhere, you know, like checking out how the writer's income develops, if you like. But no, they weren't interested in that at all. They just want the writing stuff.
That's fascinating. I know Lee Child told me that his archives are going to East Anglia University, where I gather they have a fairly active kind of writing program, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's the place to go for creative writing.
Right. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
The National Library of Scotland already has Ian Rankin's archive, and I think in the fullness of time they'll have mine.
Right, maybe Denise's as well, you know, depending on how that goes. Well, anyway, so what happens to kick this book off? What is the instigating incident of the major case? Because there's actually more than one thing happening in this book. Well,
the major case is set off by Karen's sidekick, Jason, her wingman. She's committed to trying to help Jason to be a better policeman. And so one of the things that she's got him doing a lot of is background investigations in the cases. And over the course of the last few books, he's made some contacts at the National Library because they've gone and looked up archives, gone and looked up records for him. And during lockdown, a couple of weeks into lockdown, he gets a phone call from one of the women that he's got to know at the library. And she's been troubled by something that she read before the lockdown started. She was going through a recently delivered archive from someone who had died recently. And she found an unfinished manuscript that seemed to her to map on very accurately to a disappearance of a young student the year before. And she didn't know what to do about this, if this was something to just coincidence or if it was something to be investigated. So she rings Jason up and says, do you want to have a look at this? Is this kind of your kind of thing? And so Jason tells Karen, and Karen has a think about it. And Karen thinks, I've got Jason in his flat with his fiance doing nothing. I've got Daisy, who is the new addition to the squad, sharing a flat with me at the moment. They need a training exercise. So she decides to investigate this, not sure if it actually has any connection to the real case or if it's just a set of coincidences, but thinks that the process of investigating it will be a good training exercise for her new team and a good bonding exercise for them as well. And that's where we start from. And then it gets a bit more serious and a bit more dangerous, I suppose.
It does. I really love Jake Stein, and I particularly like him when you call him one of the pioneers of the so-called tartan wire school. Well, I mean, tartan wire is a real thing, right? So, and his name, is that, I mean, that's not a Scottish name, is it? Jay Stein? Is it supposed to be kind of an American name thrust into tartan wire?
I used to work with a guy called Stein when I was a journalist, and he was from Glasgow. So Scottish people come from all over.
Very true. Now, it was the Jake more than the Stein, I thought, sounded, you know, kind of. But anyway, it's a name that fits a guy that maybe is writing, you know, tartan noir.
So, yeah, so the idea is that this manuscript sort of subsists in the world of Scottish crime writing. And if it's true, if it's an accurate description of something that really happened, then it does sort of become quite meta, I suppose, sort of book within a book. Because we get this unfinished manuscript and make of it what we will.
Well, exactly. Jake Stein had been a, you know, blockbuster bestseller, but his work or his general reputation in sales had been declining, right?
Fell from grace quite dramatically.
He did, right. And there's another writer who has never been particularly successful, but suddenly is a rising star. What do you know about chess? Because chess is an integral part of what goes on in this book. I was very impressed that you wrote about it.
I know next to nothing about chess. I don't have the temperament for chess. You know, I can't play the long game. I can't do that thing of figuring out if I do that, then you'll do that, and then I'll do that, and then you'll do that. I used to have a girlfriend who loved playing chess and tried to get me to play chess. And she gave up in the end. She said, you're just a kamikaze chess player. You just want to get as many pieces off the board as you can. I don't play, and I don't sort of really understand the nuts and bolts of the game, but you know, you don't have to understand these things to write about them. And I like so many of us, I guess, I enjoyed watching the Queen's Gambit series, which was very entertaining. So you know, you can make entertainment, you can make a movie or a book out of things you don't have to know an awful lot about if you can make it sound convincing. And I hope I made it sound convincing.
You did make it sound
about the rivalry than the actual play.
No, I think you made it very convincing, and I totally agree with you about the Queen's Gambit. I was riveted to it. Yeah. We all watched it. And, you know, I am so envious of people whose minds allow them to visualize things moving in space in three dimensions. I have, you know, I did really well with math when I was young until we got to solid geometry. And the way my brain is wired, I can't see it. You know, I just got lost in solid geometry. And then I recognized I'm not any good at checkers or Chinese checkers or backgammon, you know, anything where things have to move in space just does not work for me. So yeah. I think that was one reason I was so interested in the Queen's Gambit when she would have those moments, you know, when the pieces were kind of moving over her head. And I thought maybe that's what, you know, you were able to do that kind of manipulation.
I wish, but I don't have that kind of brain. I'm afraid I can't figure that kind of thing out. I'm not very good at games of strategy like that, which is why Joel, my partner, and my son Cameron gang up on me so easily on so many board games.
I hear you. I don't even play them anymore. You know, it's so hopeless. So yeah. Anyway, Jake Stein's manuscript, the one that is found in the National Archives and brought to the attention of the Unsolved Cases team here, is called The Vanishing of Laurel Oliver. And it turns into a rivalry between two crime writers who meet to play chess and envy each other's achievements. So we'll leave that there. But talk to me about the Syrian refugee, because another part of this plot is that Karen gets interested in, or not interested, but becomes involved in a Syrian refugee whose life is under threat.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of continuation of a backstory, if you like, that's been happening for the last 2-3 Karen Perry novels. She discovered a group of Syrian refugees who were meeting at night on a footpath because they had nowhere else to go. She used her contacts to help them put together a cafe. It's a social enterprise, a non-profit-making cafe that was originally intended just to be for a place for them to meet, but has become a very popular coffee shop and cafe in Leith. So she's got this existing relationship with the cafe and the Syrians. It turns out that a Syrian refugee has been is under threat. He was involved. He was one of the whistleblowers who revealed the torture that was going on under Assad's regime. I don't know if you remember, there was a series of photographs released revealed from inside the torture rooms of the prisons there that were really profoundly shocking. My friend Sue Black, the forensic anthropologist, was tasked with examining them to verify that they were actually authentic photographs of torture. And I think that was something that that really has stayed with her for a very long time. So I thought it would be useful and helpful to write about this, to remind people that this had gone on and that these things have consequences. So a Syrian doctor arrives with a price on his head, and they soon discover that there's a hit squad looking for him. So Karen is asked if she can help to preserve his life, and because she's got this commitment to justice and she thinks this guy's one of the good guys, she decides to break the rules and help him, and it doesn't entirely end well.
Well, no, but I mean, I think it's an interesting dilemma that, you know, she has to decide whether to break the rules. Meantime, let's talk about her living situation for a moment. I don't think it's giving anything away. Where is Karen living?
Karen is currently living in the apartment of her boyfriend, lover, Hamish, right, who also has a croft in the Highlands. And he's stayed at the croft in the Highlands because he has livestock there to take care of. And one of his shepherds has gone off somewhere else with his girlfriend. So he's not there because he's got the croft to look after. Karen is in his very lavish new town flat with its rooftop garden and everything. And it's quite a big place. And her colleague Daisy, who is the new member of the team, was on her own in a sort of crummy little flat in Fife. And so Karen had suggested in the moment of madness that they share the flat. And it was a very strange thing for Karen to decide, because she's not that sort of, she's not that sociable in some respects. But she just started working with Daisy. She really liked her, and she felt sorry for her. And so she said, she thought it was, we all thought it was going to be for a couple of weeks, that turned into months. So Daisy and Karen are sharing Hamish's rather lovely flat.
Which, of course, means that Karen's flat is somewhere else. But
yes, it's on the outside of town.
Right. So explain what you mean for those of us who didn't live that way. And I have to say, Val, that, you know, Arizona is a very big place. We have government here that is anti-restrictions. As you know, Rob and I have a big house with a big garden and all. And none of this applied to us. I mean, none of it applied to us. We could go out walking. We could go anywhere we wanted to. We could have friends in if we felt like it. But what is the sort of unit that people had to live in during lockdown, the way you write about it?
People had to live in what was called their bubble.
Right.
So if you were a family, your bubble would be, you know, like you and your kids in the same house. Or if you were with your partner, that was your bubble. And you could not have other people in the house. You could not go into other people's houses. You could go out of doors for an hour a day. And you could go no further than 5 miles from your home. So if you wanted to go to the beach, for example, if we wanted to go to the beach, we could drive down to Portobello and walk on the beach, because that was within the limit of where we could get to in the day. But that was pretty strictly it. I mean, where we are, there are parks to walk and there's a river to walk by, but you had to keep your distance from people, 2 meters distance from people who are not in your bubble. And that was that. So once you were hunkered down with somebody in lockdown or in a house in lockdown with other people, then that was your group. And that lasted for some considerable time.
It did. So once Karen made a decision to invite Daisy to live with her in her flat, that was their bubble. So yeah. Hamish, if Hamish came home, he would be intruding into their bubble.
He had
bubble.
No right to be there. He had no right to be in Edinburgh in his own flat.
And similarly, if she wants to help a Syrian refugee, she can't bring him into the flat. So, you know, there were, I think the reason I'm bringing it up is that there were ethical dilemmas that only existed due to the circumstances surrounding yes. COVID that I thought you did such a brilliant job with in this book, because they would never arise in ordinary circumstances.
No, because Karen was actually living in Hamish's flat. Her flat was empty, so she was able to use it for someone else to be in.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a time that was fraught with difficulty, and police officers had a really tough time of it in many respects, because mm-hmm. they were out there at the front line, and not everyone was obeying the rules, and you know, they were putting themselves at risk every day, and then having to go home to their families, putting them ultimately at risk. It was a very tense time for everyone.
It was, and also a very tense time for relationships, which you also develop in the course of the book. Yeah. You know, relationships can fray under those kinds of circumstances. And it's interesting to see, you know, what people are made of, what they can stand up for. So there were revelations we won't go into in the book, I thought, that were revealed by all of this. So it adds a tremendous amount of texture to the characterizations that, you know, in ordinary circumstances might never have arisen.
We quite enjoyed it, actually.
But
we quite enjoyed the chance to not go out, not go anywhere, and just have each other's company. And it wasn't so different for me from the process of writing a book. You know, write a bit, go for a walk, write a bit, sit around, read a book. And you know, Joe was getting up. We'd sort of have breakfast together. Then Joe would go off upstairs to her office. I would go to my office. We'd do our own thing. We'd come together at the end of the day and talk about what we were doing and what we were working on and what our ideas were. We actually found it, I mean, we were very well aware of how privileged we were, how lucky we were, you know, to have a spacious place to live with without having to deal with problems of, for example, small children or elderly relatives. But it was not a hardship for us in many respects. We were lucky in that respect. And we explored Edinburgh in a way we'd never done before. because after a few weeks, the parks and the river walk started to get really crowded and busy. So we decided to go up into the city, and the city was empty. It was, I mean, literally empty. And so we'd go a lot down alleyways we'd never been down before. We'd go down what they'd called closes we'd never been down before, down streets we'd never explored, and found all sorts of bits of the city. And really started to enjoy the graveyards.
Graveyards, come on, those are always fascinating to visit.
Yeah, but you don't always have the time to spend with them. We found one of the graveyards is a relative of Arthur Conan Doyle's who was kidnapped by Barbary pirates.
Wow. Well, you know, it's so true that if your circumstances were right, you could take it as a time to, you know, be very close to a few people and also to explore things that you wouldn't have time in the ordinary course of events to do, because life really slowed down.
I missed my friends, though. I mean, I really did miss my friends. And as soon as we were allowed to, the first sort of step was that you were allowed to meet people outside. You were allowed to meet one person outside if you kept your distance between you. And so I started meeting up with writer friends and going for walks in the city, often around the graveyards.
Why not?
And that was a big deal. That was very helpful.
It's amazing how we can look back, you know, because it's really it only took a short time, I think, for us to kind of go back to normal lives after this. I don't want to call it an interlude, seems awfully light for what it was, because it was a terrifying time when nobody knew what would happen and many people were very ill and dying. I had an author here last week who still has long COVID and is really suffering from it. So it's not like it just all, you know, went away.
What it really revealed
is how much sort of just general busy work we have in our lives, and it suspended a lot of it. So we had time and we noticed at the store that there was this huge interest in classics. People who never had time to read War and Peace or whatever it is, you know, suddenly people had time for it. And I loved it because it brought many readers into reading, you know, older crime novels, back to the golden age, you know, the British Library series, the American Library crime, all that. And I felt like it really gave people a chance to explore things that they were generally too busy to do.
And I think like many people, I went back to read old favorites. You know, there was a comfort to be found in reading, you know, a couple of my favorite Agatha Christies, or, you know, my favorite Reginald Hill, my favorite Barbara Vine. Going back to those and meeting again with books that I'd loved and that I felt comfortable in.
Yeah. Some writers were more prolific. Ian Rankin, for example, because we zoomed around while COVID was going on. Even Ian was doing a lot more work, whereas other writers were kind of paralyzed and really didn't feel like working. So we all reacted, you know, we all reacted differently. Creative minds reacted differently. Before I call up Patrick Val, what are you working on next? I always like to leave readers with the expectation of a new book.
Well, next year's book will be 1999, but in the interim, I've written a novella for a series called Darkland Tales, which is being published by Berlin in the UK, the Scottish publisher. And the idea behind Darkland Tales is they invite contemporary writers to re-examine an incident of Scottish history that has, I suppose, developed its own mythology around it. So Denise did Rizzio, you know, the murder of Mary Queen of Scots' secretary. Right. Alan Warner did Bonnie Prince Charlie's flight across the heather, and David Gregg has just done the Viking raid on Iona. So I've just finished a novella about the real Lady Macbeth.
Cheer. Oh, well, that ought to be wonderful. Will it be coming out from your Grove Atlantic publisher here in the States?
I hope so. I've only just finished it. I mean, it's due. It'll be out in the UK in May. And I hope roughly the same time for Grove, but I know they like a longer lead time.
And then, I'm sorry, what is the book, the full novel that you're working on?
The full novel for next year will be 1999. So Return to Ali Burns.
Ah, wonderful. Well, Patrick, let's come and see whether people have comments or questions that they would like to introduce.
All right. Well, one of the first questions was, when will we see Ali Burns again? So you've just answered that.
Yeah, next year.
Next year, that's great. Yeah, a number of people are just kind of chiming in with their thoughts about COVID and this whole period. Renee says, I'm glad that COVID did allow people to post interviews, discussions, especially in regard to books. Yeah, we did a ton of these over COVID. Mm. And it really has had a dramatic change. I mean, here we are doing it again. Whereas pre-COVID, you know, it might not have occurred to us, right, Barbara, that we could do this as
well,
easily.
Well, we didn't really have the tool, Patrick. Zoom came along at an absolutely magical moment. Think yep. about it, you know. And indeed, it has made it possible for us to talk to authors from all over in right. a way that wouldn't make any sense at all. Wouldn't have been possible, let alone made any sense. I think the most interesting thing, and I keep looking at it, Val, Rob decided that the Zoom soundtrack would be ideal to turn into a podcast. I mean, without anything other than the soundtrack. And I looked this yesterday when I was writing our e-news, and there are 261,000 downloads of those podcasts.
Wow, that's
which
amazing.
Has created this incredible archive, you know. And it's all since April of 2020, you know, so yeah. It hasn't even been 4 years. And, you know, that was not anything that would have been. He's now working with some kind of program and somebody to create an index for it, because there's so many of them, you can't go in and just, you know, find anything anymore. And I thought, I never expected to really leave or have the store leave a legacy, you know, but it's turned yeah. out that between the videos and the audios, Patrick, you know, we are leaving an incredible legacy for people to explore, you know, for a really long time. And so that's been a totally unexpected opportunity that would never have come our way.
Yeah.
Without Zoom and without COVID, it took the two together to make it work.
Yep. And everybody's doing it, the podcast thing. Jo's even got her own podcast series now in her role as Geographer Royal for Scotland.
I love it. Well, you know, when I say podcast, that's really not what these are. These are just the recording of the conversation that you and I are having, which is yeah. not, I think, actually a podcast, but, you know, it's an easy thing to call it. That sort yeah. of makes sense to people.
People understand what they're getting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, Val, I was going to ask you about 1999. I had a conversation with the writer David Swinson, who was a really terrific novelist, and he wrote a police procedural set in D.C. In 1999, at just as it was coming up to the, you know, the last months of 1999, and we were talking about it, and it's hard to imagine. In the 23 years, whatever, since, in that period of time, more change, you know, he was going back and he was saying, you know, he's writing about all this kind of, you know, millennial panic that was, everybody was afraid that there were going to be riots in the streets. And, but just the technology that the police were issued their very first Nextel cell phones. on the police squad, and you know, while some of them liked it, a lot of the cops were like, "Oh shit! Now they can reach me anytime," you know. And you know, pagers were so much more convenient for that reason.
Yeah,
I was just thinking about how it's hard to imagine a chunk of time where there has been more profound change than these last 23 years. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things that intrigued me about writing this quintet of novels, that I can follow those technological changes and those societal changes that have happened in our lives, but also in our crimes. And that to me is a really fascinating approach to be able to take. And I think it's, I don't know, it's a challenge, isn't it? I mean, it's the fascination of what's difficult, isn't it? As Yeats called it.
Right. All right. Have you read?
But, I mean, also, sorry. The other thing about 1999 is in my universe, my books exist in 1999.
That's true.
My characters are out there in 1999. There's no reason why Ali Burns can't bump into Carol Jordan or Kate Branigan in the course of what she's doing. So it offers up lots of kind of crossover possibilities, which I'm figuring out how to exploit to maximum benefit.
Right.
I love that. That's wonderful.
Intermittent your era. Yeah, the early era of your books.
It's my universe. I can do what I want with it.
That's right. Let's see here. Any other questions that have come in? Yes, Robin asks, what is the name of the collaborative book that you mentioned earlier? By collaborative, I think what she meant, the Macbeth, the true.
The Macbeth one is going to be called Blood Will Out.
Blood Will Out, okay. I think
Blood Will Out. It's either Blood Will Out or Blood Will Have Blood. I can't remember which it is at the moment.
Gotcha. Great. And when will that be released? Next year? Or?
Next year. It'll be out in May in the UK. I'm not sure what the schedule will be in the US.
Great.
Is that it?
I think that's about it, Barbara.
Okay. I have one more question. Bloody Scotland, what can you tell me for benefit of people who are listening and also for me? About Bloody Scotland, is that something? I know you've gone to Harrogate often, and you, in fact, are a rock star in a band, you know, the musical Val McDermid, which I have yet to experience. But what is Bloody Scotland as a crime festival like?
It's great. It's a really good festival. It's got very good events. It's imaginative. It covers the pitch pretty well, not just Scottish crime writers, but internationally as well. It's a festival well worth attending.
Are you planning to go in September?
I'll be there. I won't be there next year because I'll be in New Zealand.
Well, bummer, because I was thinking of coming, but part of the reason
but
I
I'll
was
definitely be there in 2025. I'll definitely be there in 2025.
Okay. Well, then maybe I'll postpone it because, you know, it's been a long time since we hung out together.
Yeah.
And I would.
But it's a good festival. The band won't be playing next year because I won't be there, but the band will probably be playing in 2025. Yeah.
Any other upcoming gigs?
Yeah, I can't really talk about much about what's coming up this year, but I've just been told that we'll definitely be playing at Edinburgh in the summer.
Oh, great. Yeah.
We've got some stuff in the pipeline, as they say.
Are you going to
we celebrated our 40th gig last summer.
Wow.
Just the summer just gone there was on the Isle of Bute was our 40th gig.
So, who's the bandmates for the big benefit of people who don't know, besides you and Mark?
Mark Billingham, Chris Brookmeyer, Luca Vesti, Doug Johnson, and Stuart Neville.
Fabulous group. Are you going to Harrogate?
We're not, the band's not playing at Harrogate this year. We did Harrogate last year, but I will be at Harrogate, yeah.
Okay, well, that's another possibility. Well, Val, thank you very much for your time. It's been great
it's been
to
a pleasure.
See you again.
Always.
And I rave and will continue to rave about Past Lying, which is a remarkable book. You've never read Val before, you don't read Karen Puri. It's a book you really got to read as a way of reminding yourself, because we've moved so far away from it so fast, aside from the great story and all the rest of it, it's really has captured, for me anyway, what COVID was like in a way that I have found very little else has covered. You did a brilliant job with it. Absolutely.
Thank you.
And we
Good
do have
you guys.
Copies. Let me just remind everybody, we still have a few autographed copies of Past Lying in the UK edition. And as Patrick said, we have plenty of copies of the US, but they aren't autographed. So there we are. All right. Bye, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Bye.
Bye,
Val.
Bye.
Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Hope
and the
to
same
see
to
you soon.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.